So we're here with Federico Fuentes from the Australia-Venezuela Solidarity Network and also with Green Left. And we want to focus on COVID-19 in Venezuela and also, I guess, a bit more broadly in Latin America as well. And now, Venezuela has done remarkably well compared to other Latin American countries, and I mean, obviously, especially compared to the United States, in dealing with COVID-19. But this is all under the fact that it's under a sanctions regime as well. So that actually makes it doubly remarkable. Can you just start off, Fred, by just laying out what is the situation for people who aren't familiar with it? How has Venezuela gone in dealing with COVID-19?
Yeah, I think part of the importance or way to understand how Venezuela has gone about combating COVID-19 is important to consider two contexts. The first is one that you mentioned, which is the very large and devastating impacts of the economic sanctions, mainly imposed by the United States, but also a number of other European countries, has had in general on the Venezuelan economy, but also specifically on the health system. So much so where it can essentially be said that in large parts, the hospital system, public hospital system in Venezuela has largely collapsed over the last few years. So, of course, in a context of what COVID-19 pandemic has meant in other countries, this meant it was almost, you know, it was vital that the government was to move quickly to try to suppress it and stamp it out before it got under control. The second important aspect, though, to remember as well is that whilst on the one hand, the public hospital system has largely collapsed, at the local level, the networks that have been built involving local doctors, in many cases, Cuban doctors, together with health committees, local community activists, communal councils, has played an important role in sort of creating a strong culture of preventative medicine, of community health, and general health awareness amongst the population in Venezuela. So this was really the strong point that the government had in its pocket to be able to deal with COVID-19. So how did it respond? Almost as soon as word came out of the pandemic or the outbreak of COVID-19 in China, the Venezuelan government very quickly engaged the Chinese government to work out what was happening and how it could begin to combat COVID-19. Once it was to hit Venezuela or to try to stop it hitting Venezuela. Within a few months, it began to stop international travel or certainly quarantine those that were coming in to the country. And also, once the first few cases emerged in Venezuela, very quickly moved from a regional lockdown of a couple of states through to an entire national lockdown or quarantine, as they call it. Where essentially everyone was to stay home except for the absolute most basic needs, shopping for food, healthcare, whilst using an online platform that the government set up to let the government and local health officials know if they had any symptoms so that doctors and community activists could go to their home to test them to see who was testing positive for COVID and where those cases were found to be positive with COVID, being able to find them a suitable venue for them to receive treatment. If that was possible at home, then that happened at home. But if cramped living conditions meant that that was not possible, then they were moved into specially designed venues or local health centres in order to be treated there. Essentially, what is of the health system was dedicated fully to dealing with COVID. And that had a really remarkable success. And even to date, Venezuela has, as you said, pretty much been leading the region in terms of low level of cases and deaths. What we are, though, seeing is that added to those to that problem of the economic sanctions that was mentioned before, Venezuela is now encountering another big problem in trying to deal with COVID. And that is the return of many Venezuelans. As is quite well known, there's been a large emigration of Venezuelans over the last few years due to the economic and political situation. Many of those migrants, as with the case of many migrants around the world, have found themselves with little to no protections in the countries where they've gone to reside. And in that context, many have chosen to go home. So we've essentially seen something like 70,000 Venezuelans returned back to the country over the last 2-3 months. Almost most large, the last bulk of them crossing from the Colombian border. So that's essentially Venezuelans returning from Ecuador, Peru, Colombia. Now, government's tried as best as possible to provide for quarantine measures in order to allow everyone, of course, to return home, but in a safe manner. Where everyone is tested and where everyone is ensured that there's not a spread of the virus. But what we've seen is that just in the last few weeks, following a relaxation of that nationwide quarantine, the government has had to go back into a hard lockdown in particularly the border states and in Caracas, given the large poor neighbourhoods that exist there. And this has been, as I said, in large part due to having to deal with this return of Venezuelan residents, or who in many cases wanting to escape quarantine, been crossing the very porous Venezuelan Colombian border through many different means. So there's a big challenge. But as I've said, importantly, the government has faced with a health system, or particularly a hospital system, would never have been able to deal with this situation, being forced or chosen to rely on the mobilisation of local health committees, of local doctors, to really tackle this issue.
In the sort of topsy-turvy, black-is-white world of the Western media, Venezuela is presented as being a dictatorship and Maduro is a dictator. And we've got also this, you know, supposed self-declared presidential alternative, Juan Guaido. Nearby, we have Bolivia, where there's been a coup taken place, but in the eyes of the Western media, at least at the time when it was happening, that was presented as a step towards, you know, democracy. Well, can you explain how the different responses have been in Venezuela compared to Bolivia, and in particular with reference to this question of democracy?
Certainly. But just before I get to that point, though, because you mentioned Juan Guaido and as the supposed interim president, I think that's another factor to include in just how difficult the situation has been for Venezuela to deal with. Because very early on, for example, the Venezuelan government applied to the International Monetary Fund in order to receive a loan for emergency health work to be able to combat COVID-19. But precisely because the IMF has, if I want to be generous, remain neutral on who is the actual president in Venezuela, whilst in practice really recognising Juan Guaido as the president, said that it was unable to facilitate those loans. The same thing has happened with the European Union. The same thing has happened with attempts by Venezuela to get access to its gold in the Bank of England. All of these have been attempts to try to use or access funds to be able to combat COVID-19. But has consistently been undermined by this spurious interim presidency of Juan Guaido that has received the backing of just a handful of Western nations, while the majority of the countries in the world continue to recognise President Maduro as the legitimate president of Venezuela. Of course, when we contrast this with Bolivia, we also there have an interim president in the form of Jeanine Añez. However, this is an interim president who actually is the de facto head of state, because she was able to come to power on the back of a coup that removed former president Evo Morales following elections late last year. Jeanine Añez was installed as the president after Morales was forced to resign because of this coup, and was only meant to preside over an interim presidency that was meant to see elections occur on May 1. Instead, what we've seen is that Jeanine Añez still remains in power, has been as much as possible attempting to avoid elections, using the pandemic as an excuse to suppress democracy, and has been exposed to have been completely inept, completely failed in the attempt to actually deal with the pandemic in Bolivia, where you now have a situation where morgues are unable to deal with the amount of deaths that are occurring. So dead bodies are left to be basically out on the streets. Families have no place to be able to bury their dead, seeing horrific scenes. What we've seen is that the Bolivian government's response, far from being a health-first response, was ultimately or primarily framed as a maintenance of power response. So what did this involve? It involved a number of things. Firstly, involved maintaining and escalating the repression it had already been carrying out against dissidents, in particular members of the Movements Towards Socialism, the party that Evo Morales heads, and is the main contender in the upcoming presidential elections that have now finally been rescheduled for September 1, although we'll see if they actually go ahead on those days. So whilst the repression was already underway, under the guise of the pandemic, the government has been using so-called health threats to imprison, detain, to persecute members of the movement towards socialism. We've also seen alongside this repression, an attempt by the government to politicise the pandemic. We've even had scandalous cases where hospitals that were projects that are being started under the Evo Morales government and which were due to be opened, having their opening delayed so that the new interim government could paint the hospitals green, which is the colour of the party that Añez will be running for, in order to then be able to present these as somehow projects that her new interim government had brought about as part of the electioneering that's going on. So again, a prioritisation of the maintenance of power rather than the real basic health needs. Another important differentiation between the way the Venezuelan government has handled the pandemic and the Bolivian government is that while both have imposed national lockdowns at different degrees and at different times, Venezuelan government has always made as big attempt to at least try to alleviate the worst aspects of those national lockdowns, essentially covering wages of workers in public and private sector, reducing, if not completely eliminating, rents, payment of bills, these kind of hardships that, of course, you're unable to pay for if you're unable to go to work. Whereas in Bolivia, very little was offered. At first, nothing was offered. Only when initial protests against the quarantine began did the government essentially bump up a bit of the existing social payments that were already being handed out as a result of the Evo Morales government and a couple of one-off payments that were given out. And then finally decided that rather than try to bear any more economic cost, would simply start to lift the quarantine and allow people to go to work. And what we've seen as a result is just an escalation of the cases and deaths in Bolivia, a crisis that's already seen one health minister resign. It's already seen the government involved in a corruption scandal for overbilling of ventilators into the country. So it's just been scandal after scandal, which itself has then been reflected in Jeanine Añez's decline in the polls, where many had seen her as the potential unity candidate to challenge against the movement towards socialism. Whereas now the polls show her as a distant third. So it's in that case, it's unsurprising that she's been seeking to delay the elections to try to see if she can regain some political capital before Bolivians go to the polls in a situation where current polls are indicating that were elections to be held today, the movement towards socialism would not only come first in the elections, but would be an outright winner and avoid a second round, given the lead that they've now got against the second favourite candidate.
It's you spoke about the whole coup attempt and Juan Guaido supposed self-declared presidency. It's quite striking to me that the United States in foreign policy in the time of this global pandemic has also not been putting health first. So you've seen the tightening of the screws against Iran and also tightening of the screws against Venezuela as well. Can you speak about some of those aspects of what the United States has been doing tighten the screws against Maduro's Venezuela?
Yeah, I think there's a plane coming over.
Okay, all right, that's fine. We'll wait a moment. I can't hear the plane anymore. It's gone for me.
Okay. Yeah, look, I think just as the Maduro government realised that it had a huge challenge on its hand, not just because COVID-19 is a huge challenge for any government, but because of the precarious economic and situation of the health system, the US administration also saw this as very much an opportunity that if it could very much tighten the screws, it could hope to achieve what its supposed aim or its real aim of the sanctions is basically to strangle the economy with the hope of creating some kind of internal uprising or some kind of internal fracture within the government. To bring down Maduro. So we've seen a number of tightening of sanctions. We've seen the attempts to block the entrance of Iranian tankers carrying petrol. One of the latest shortages to really start hitting hard in Venezuela is petrol, something that that seems illogical given the huge oil reserves that Venezuela has, but essentially in large part because of the effects of these sanctions and the debilitation of the state oil company PDVSA, Venezuela is not really in a position now to be able to refine its oil into petrol, and so it's faced extreme shortages in this commodity. So really the US government has thought, well, now we could tighten, if we tighten the sanctions now, this could really be the time where things begin to erupt. And it must be noted that there have been, whilst small scale, not completely insignificant protests, riots, cases of looting, by and large in smaller, medium-sized towns, perhaps those towns that have been the hardest for government efforts to get to resolve the issues, or others might say perhaps the ones that have been least prioritised while the government has focused on the bigger cities, in part for electoral, political reasons, in part because if the COVID was to spread in those areas, it would have the largest and most devastating impact. But at the same time, the government's ability, the Venezuelan government's ability to respond to COVID and how it has responded to it has almost overwhelmingly been seen as a positive, even including by detractors of the government. Very few are willing to say that the government has mishandled the situation. Some may claim that the figures are a bit rubbery, they're not completely accurate, but when people look around to on Brazil to the right of Venezuela, to Peru and Ecuador and Chile on geographically to the left or politically to the right of Venezuela and see the disasters that are happening there, it's very hard to fault the way that the Venezuelan government has dealt with this pandemic. And it's really put the US in a bind because it's sort of and we've seen it with some of the statements that have been coming out of the US administration, either publicly or sort of through back channels, that there's sort of a real sense that perhaps the whole adventure with Juan Guaido, including the latest episode being just a couple of weeks ago with the attempted invasion by US, Colombian and Venezuelan mercenaries, spectacularly failing, that many are sort of seeing that there's really little left in this project of the Juan Guaido interim presidency. And what's more, it now faces the challenge of how to deal with National Assembly elections that have been scheduled for later this year in Venezuela, given that the National Assembly has really been the kind of the body that the opposition have used to portray as the last remaining democratic institution, and have used to give some kind of pretext or some kind of cover for the Juan Guaido presidency.
Just briefly speaking about these sanctions, I mean, look, probably unless Australians are following Venezuela closely, they might not even know about the sanction regime. But just to clarify, these are illegal sanctions under international law, aren't they?
Yeah, the sanctions are essentially defined as collective punishment and therefore seen as illegal by the United Nations. We have a range of sanctions, and generally the focus that's given to the sanctions by the US government and by supporters of the sanctions is this idea that they are just individual sanctions targeting individual officials in the regime to supposedly stop them from being able to get access to their corrupt earnings. The reality is, though, that the sanctions are much, much deeper and broader than that. And even if we just look at some of the individual sanctions, these are specifically targeted individual sanctions against key ministers in the government, which essentially stop those ministries being able to carry out any kind of trade agreements with other countries. Already there, they have a much broader impact than just supposedly freezing bank accounts of individuals. But they also extend to companies doing dealings with Venezuela. They extend to in the case of Citgo, the US subsidiary of the state oil company PDVSA, essentially the theft of that affiliate, PDVSA affiliate, and handing it over to Juan Guaido. And Citgo has been an important part of the funds and the trade that Venezuela's had in terms of oil with the United States. All of these different sanctions really amount to, as I said, a collective punishment with the aim, even though they won't explicitly say this, but it's always really been what's driven a lot of these sanctions regimes, this conception that by strangling the economy and making the situation as unbearable as possible, the hope will be that people will turn against the government. Firstly, not only has history in general shown that that does not happen, If anything, it only tends to solidify support with the state under siege. More importantly, in the case of Venezuela, an important section of the population continues to identify with that government politically and sees that even despite these sanctions, that government is working in its interest to try to, in this case, very specifically, as we've been talking about, deal with the COVID-19 pandemic in the best possible way to save as many lives as possible.
Whenever we're in general campaigning for socialism, one of the common retorts you'll get is, oh, socialism, you don't want to end up like Venezuela. And I think if we look at the international response to this pandemic, it's obviously not all one way, and clearly a virus doesn't care about political ideology. But some of the countries that have had the best responses, like Venezuela, but also Vietnam and Cuba, are clearly sort of left-wing governments. And some of the governments that have had the worst response, like, I mean, obviously, I mean, Brazil, I think, would be up there. But even the United States is right-wing and not, under Trump, it's almost like right-wing, not in just the sort of traditional mainstream right, but it's perhaps a bit further right than that. And some of the other right-wing governments in the world have also handled this crisis very badly. Are there ways in which a left-wing approach can help to solve practical problems like this?
I think there's very concrete evidence that where governments have taken a progressive left-wing approach to healthcare, whether that be from heavily funding a healthcare system so that it has an adequate healthcare system that can, for instance, in the case of Cuba, not just deal with combating COVID-19 at home, but actually is in a position to send doctors overseas to help other countries combat the pandemic. Whether it be because of progressive policies that understand that whilst certain measures may be needed to tackle the pandemic, such as home quarantine or state or regional or national lockdowns may be required, that those measures must be accompanied with measures that look after people's livelihoods if they are to in any way be successful. Otherwise, they are bound to fail. And we've seen that in numerous countries. As I mentioned before, Bolivia just being one example of where the lockdown just had, was unsustainable. And so therefore, rather than try to deal with that unsustainability, the government instead preferred to just begin to slowly lift it. And we're seeing the deaths that are occurring there. There's a lot of examples of how these kind of policies have been far better equipped to deal with the pandemic. And we've even seen it in the case of where in a number of cases, right-wing governments basically having lost complete control of the pandemic have been forced to implement policies that, only weeks before they were decrying as so-called socialist communist policies. I think perhaps in some ways it's no clearer example of, in Britain, where the Boris Johnson government having completely failed in the first few weeks of the pandemic, essentially moved to implement a whole raft of economic policies that it were just as, if not probably bigger in terms of their size than what Jeremy Corbyn had been offering in the last elections and which the media had decried as left-wing lunacy. So the circumstances themselves have in some cases forced governments to go against their own political so-called ideologies or principles in order to implement other policies. So I think there is a very strong lesson to be learned there. Of course, it doesn't resolve everything. As you've mentioned, it is true. I don't think many people would want to live the current situation that Venezuela is in at the moment, putting aside the way they've dealt with the pandemic. The economic situation there is extremely dire, but it's, of course, extremely dire for a whole range of reasons. The critics like to just focus on, it's all to blame with socialism, but ignore the history of colonialism, ignore the fact that Venezuela's economy has been completely dependent on oil well before Chavez and Maduro were in power, that the country they inherited had extremely high levels of poverty, was an issue that only the Chavez government began to deal with. It's had to deal with economic sanctions. It's had to deal with hostile opposition internally within the country that has led to sabotage of the oil industry. That's a regular attempted coups. Any government would be hard pressed to still be in power, let alone to be able to radically transform in society. But I think what we see is that what is so powerful about these ideas is, you know, the fact that they do pose an alternative. They do show that something different can be done on a certain level. That's been seen with this pandemic, although of course very, very few of the media are willing to pay any much attention to what's happening in, whether it be Venezuela or Cuba or Vietnam or the state of Kerala in India or many other places where progressive or left-wing forces are in power. The counter, I think, is certainly that if the deaths in Venezuela were anywhere near on a per capita basis what we've seen in countries like Brazil or Peru, Ecuador, you could absolutely be certain that it would be, you know, up at the top of the international news sections with renewed calls to have to get rid of the Maduro government in order to deal with the health impacts that is occurring. A call that you see in none of these other countries where you have, particularly in Brazil, you know, essentially a government that's explicitly stated it has no problem, or certainly at least a president, that it has no problems with the spread of this deadly pandemic occurring in his own country. So I think there is a lot of validity to that. It's important to be able to get some of this information out about how these responses are occurring, because it also can be useful for drawing some kind of lessons to how in our own countries, in our own struggles, we can begin to also put forward concrete proposals that are not only just good ideas, but that can actually chime in or that can actually sort of come together with people's struggles, people's campaigns for trying to deal with the hardships, the both health, social and economic hardships that they're facing as a result of this pandemic.
Thanks everyone for joining us today. Thanks Fred for those insights. I would like to make one final plug again. Please become a Green Left Weekly supporter. It makes a big difference to our project. Again, if you haven't shared this video, please share the video and give it a thumbs up. See you next time.